Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, partner at the Calfee Law Firm. And on today's show, we perform a comprehensive review of a rule proposal from earlier in 2024 with potentially the biggest long-term impact to the RIA community, namely the AML rule proposal from FinCEN. In our headline section, we review a recent decision from the Fifth Circuit Court to stay the new DOL fiduciary rule that was issued earlier this year. And finally, we'll wrap up today's show with another installment of What's On My Mind, where we take a quick moment to visit the 2024 Paris Olympics and review how some of the greatest athletes in the world can give us a critical insight into being the best versions of ourselves and building our firm's best compliance program. Diving into the headlines portion of the show, on July 25th, 2024, in the case of Federation of Americans for Consumer Choice, Inc. versus the United States Department of Labor, the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Texas issued an order staying the effective date of the DOL's final fiduciary rule and related amendments to PTE 8414 that was issued in March 2024. The final rule, which we had previously talked about on this show, including with an interview from Fred Riesch, had expanded the definition of investment advice fiduciary with respect to employee benefit plans and IRAs for purposes of determining who is a fiduciary under the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, or ERISA, and imposes ERISA's fiduciary protections on many types of investment advisory relationships that were previously exempted under the DOL's prior regulatory definition of investment advice fiduciary, which had been the standard since essentially 1975. The district court, in part, relying on the Supreme Court's recent ruling in the Loper-Bright case, which we also talked about on our last episode, found that the plaintiffs, who were primarily insurance agents, were likely to succeed on their arguments that the final rule improperly expanded the definition of an investment advice fiduciary under ERISA. As a result, the final rule's original effective date of September 23rd, 2024, has been delayed until further notice. In addition, on July 26, 2024, in a companion case to the Federation of Americans filed in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Texas, the effectiveness of the remaining PTE amendments included in the final rule. So these are things like 2020-02, 75-1, 77-4, 80-83, 83-1, et cetera, that were not challenged in that Federation of Americans case were also stayed in the companion case, with the Northern District of Texas noting that it fully agreed with the Eastern District's analysis and decision staying the effective date of the final rule. As you might expect, the Department of Labor, the Department of Labor plans to appeal both rulings to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And that appeal process is likely going to involve much further legal scrutiny and could even potentially reach higher courts like the U.S. Supreme Court. In light of these decisions, many, many financial firms and other professionals are probably thinking, what should I do next? Well, first off, appeals of these types are likely going to take some time and involve quite a bit of process. And so consequently, you know, barring any kind of interim order from the Fifth Circuit, I think it's important that for any of those folks that have been making significant changes to their business or operations as a result of the new DOL fiduciary rule, in light of the prior September 23rd deadline, are likely going to want to hit pause, at least for now, until we get any kind of additional guidance. The other thing I would keep in mind is that the outcome of the upcoming presidential election is very much up in the air, and that's only going to add to the uncertainty here regarding the ultimate direction of the Department of Labor under a new administration. Even if the Department of Labor does appeal these decisions, it's certainly possible that a new administration may take action to either modify or render moot kind of what that final rule looked like. Securities professionals are certainly already required to adhere to a certain fiduciary standard or regulation best interest at the federal level. And many states continue to have similar standards of care. So as a result of that, many of these professionals already, hopefully, already had some of those structures and processes in place. And hopefully those firms and for all those compliance officers out there, you know, continue to help educate your financial professionals that they should continue to keep doing what they're doing and making sure that they're providing the proper disclosures, getting the proper client acknowledgments whenever necessary, and making sure that they're kind of following the process as it relates to those, you know, IRA rollovers. Finally, insurance professionals would certainly seem to have the most distance to cover in the event that a final rule was ultimately reinstated by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. However, I think, again, pause for these, you know, professionals is likely the best course for now, because many insurers had already started to kind of make some strides in preparation for that final rule. So it's not that that work is completely going to be undone here. So you can hang on to that in case it is reinstated. And also, many states have already adopted best interest standards. So again, there were likely already, hopefully, some of those processes that were already in place. As we move into the interview section of today's show, I am incredibly pleased to be joined by two fantastic guests to talk about an incredibly important topic in the securities compliance area, and one that has received a lot of news recently. I'm talking about specifically the Department of the Treasury's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, or FinCEN, recently, a little bit earlier this year, issuing a set of rulemaking that would include investment advisors to have those RIAs apply AML and other types of requirements pursuant to the Bank Secrecy Act. Joining us on the podcast today, I'm thrilled to welcome back Mr. Ed Wegener, and new to the show, but very pleased to have her join us today, is Ms. Laura Goldzung. So I'll kick it over to both Ed and Laura to introduce themselves, and then we'll dive into the topic proper. Ms. Goldzung, why don't we start with you?
Okay, well, thank you, Patrick. So I'm Laura Goldzung. I run a little firm called AML Audit Services, and as the name implies, that's all we do, is independent reviews, audits, and independent testing, all synonymous in their term. I've been in the financial services industry since I was a teenager. And it goes back about 40 years or so, a little over 40 years. I've been with a retail brokerage. I've been a manager of a retail brokerage. I was managing director at SIA, now SIPMA. So I've been around the street, as they say. I've been running the firm now for about 15 years. Our specialty really began with broker-dealers because I knew that business the best. And since I lead all the audits, we stayed on that track, and then we started to expand to virtually any financial institution that is required by law to have an AML program, and then some. We have voluntary programs as well for those companies that are associated with banks and have to cover the bank's requirements to have a program.
Well, I can definitely tell you we are going to be leveraging the heck out of that experience today. So very much appreciate that, and looking forward to really diving in here to the conversation. Ed, I'll kick it over to you.
Well, thanks, Patrick, and always appreciate being on the podcast. I'm an avid listener of the podcast, so really appreciate being invited to be here today. I'm Ed Wegener. I am the head of the governance, risk, and compliance practice at Oyster Consulting. Prior to that, for most of my career, I worked for FINRA and was responsible for reviewing firms and their compliance, broker-dealer firms and their compliance with AML requirements. Most recently at FINRA, I was the head of the Midwest region, and we did surveillance and examinations of all the firms that were within that region, including AML examinations of those firms. So again, really appreciate the opportunity to be here. At Oyster, we do a number of services with respect to money laundering, anti-money laundering programs. We set up AML programs for firms. We do annual testing. In certain cases, we'll act as an outsourced AML CO. So we've been following the developments around investment advisors very closely because we do have a number of investment advisory clients and want to make sure that we're keeping them abreast of the requirements as they get closer to being adopted by FinCEN and the SEC.
That is fantastic, Ed. Thank you for sharing that background. And just like Laura, I know we're going to be able to really leverage that experience in a very significant way today. Ed, let's go ahead and stay with you, I think, as we start to kind of dive into the rule proposal proper. Maybe could you tell us a little bit about what the rule proposal says and what some of the potential impact might be?
Sure. And thanks again, Patrick. Maybe I'll start from a really high level just to talk about, you know, the changes, how they'll impact, and we can get into more detail around the specific requirements. But earlier this year, FinCEN proposed adding investment advisors as designated financial institutions for AML and CFT purposes. And then additionally, following on that, FinCEN and the SEC issued a joint proposal that would require investment advisors to comply with the customer identification and verification requirements, as well as the requirements to identify and verify identities of certain beneficial owners of legal entity customers. So in a nutshell, the impact will be that once this rule becomes effective and we meet the implementation date, investment advisors are going to have virtually the same requirements that certain other financial institutions have with respect to AML programs, including broker-dealers. So many investment advisors who have affiliated broker-dealers are well aware of those requirements, but we're working with all of our investment advisor clients to understand what those expectations and requirements may be and how they can prepare for that.
Has there been any input or any similar statements from the SEC that relate to this topic and even maybe the FinCEN rule proposal?
You know, I think that the main input that the SEC has in this regard is that FinCEN did mention in its proposal that they would be deferring examination and enforcement activities to the SEC with respect to these requirements. And so, much like they do with broker-dealers, where FinCEN has created the broad requirements with respect to AML programs, they delegate the examination and enforcement responsibilities to the SEC, unlike broker-dealers who have where that delegation has also gone to FINRA, in this case, because they are investment advisors that would stay with the SEC. So I would expect that, you know, as when the rule becomes effective and as we start approaching the implementation date, that the SEC will provide additional guidance for investment advisors in terms of expectations with respect to what they'll be looking for when they do conduct examinations. Separately, though, with respect to the CIP and beneficial ownership requirements, FinCEN specifically issued a joint proposal because the way those rules need to be written. So that was a joint proposal between FinCEN and the SEC with respect to those requirements.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, thank you for that context. And that actually, that sets up really well, thinking about the potential that you might have an SEC examination team asking about some of your internal controls in this area to talk about the rule proposal and where some of the significant impact might be. Specifically, maybe Laura, I can turn to you for this question. You know, what will advisors need to do? What kind of, you know, expectations should be in place from a compliance perspective? And what are some of the elements in the rule proposal that kind of get flushed out in that respect?
Well, starting with the basics, the basic application here is a program. If the advisors already have an affiliate that's a BD, they can leverage certainly some things and some knowledge with the BD, but let's say they don't. They need to create a system of internal controls, which is written policies and procedures. They need to designate an AML officer, whether they have somebody internally that they've identified or they reach out to an OYSTER consultant, for example, and engage a third-party AMLCO. Conducting training is hugely important because people have to understand why they're suddenly sucked into this requirement and what the requirement really means to them in their day-to-day. And then finally, scheduling independent testing. Now, typically, independent testing is seen on an annual basis, but that's not always the rule. Depending on what the SEC is going to lay out, they may, in fact, identify annual testing. such as FINRA has for the reviews. But in other financial institution worlds, it's periodic. So they decide. They decide if it's 12 to 18 months, if it's going to be really at the commensurate level with the risk assessment, how periodic, or what the frequency is really going to be. Going back to training for a minute, though, the training is hugely important because in your policies and procedures, you really need to set up what you're going to do for new hires, right? And then what you're going to do to refresh training every year. You know, some companies do two or three different training events a year, depending on what it is. I have IA clients who do an online module, plus they do an in-person PowerPoint presentation. And today, the challenge with in-person is there's not a lot of in-person anymore. Everything is virtual to some extent. But you can still accomplish that through an internet tool such as Zoom. In addition to all the training and those four, we'll call them the four pillars of ML, they may be subject to the CIP and CBD. There are some people that argue that's a fifth pillar. I don't want to get into that at the moment, but suffice to say that beneficial ownership is, to me, a benefit. It'll actually know your client just a little bit better and the people that speak for the client. In the old days, it was always the authorized rep, and you made sure that you identify the authorized rep. Today, it's the beneficial in their entirety. In addition, in the BD world and others, there's a CTR requirement for currency over $10,000. But in the case of the RIAs, it appears it's going to be the Form 8300. The distinction here really is that probably nobody will bring in currency. No one does carry that kind of currency. And it's for that reason that they assign these to some extent, because they know they're going to bring currency. So it's not a... it's not a terrible looks for it work. I don't think it'll work. Suffice to say that they're not going to need to file it.
Yeah.
And if it were, it's a simple one. So it's not an inconvenience. It takes 2 minutes. The aggregation, however, of monies coming up to or totaling $10,000 might make a little bit of an impact, but it's really a no-brainer. And then finally, the independent test really wraps up what the AML program appears to be doing. In other words, has it been effective? Is it adequate? Is it thorough enough? Is it all, are all the pieces in place? So the testing is an important element to all of that.
Did you have anything that you wanted to add to that as far as the kind of expectations and what advisors need to do?
Yeah, just a couple of things. One of the things that I probably should have mentioned earlier is just sort of the scope of this and who's covered in terms of these requirements. And so FinCEN in the proposal says that the proposed rule would cover SEC registered investment advisors as well as exempt reporting advisors. Interestingly, though, they say for SEC registered advisors, it does not cover advisors to mutual funds, as they believe that mutual funds had their own independent requirements to have AML programs. And so they recognize that. Additionally, it doesn't cover state registered investment advisors. So those are important things to know. So if you're listening, depending on which category advisor you're in, that'll really drive whether you have these requirements. Just one follow-up on the cash reporting requirements. Interestingly, broker-dealers as well, it's very rare that broker-dealers accept cash. Most of them have policies and procedures that say that they won't accept cash. But I have seen regulators come in and want to see procedures that document that fact that the firm doesn't accept cash, has procedures that say what happens in the case of somebody trying to deposit cash, and then making sure that there's training so that the individuals who are subject to the AML requirements and AML policies know that to the extent that somebody tries to deposit cash within the registered investment advisor, that the firm that they know how to escalate those issues and report that internally. So even though it's likely that that's not going to be something you're going to have to worry too much about, it's good to have those in your procedures just to make sure, A, the regulators are okay with it, but B, so that everybody knows what to do in those cases.
Yeah. One other follow-up that I had, and again, this is a fantastic, you know, way to frame, I think, the broader way. Really appreciate how you both have kind of laid this out for those new parties that are likely going to be affected by the rule proposal. But is back to that training aspect. And, you know, I think this is probably a little bit subjective, but I would certainly be interested in your thoughts as, you know, what is the significance of the training that, that likely is going to be expected on this particular subject matter area? Is it something where you would expect most firms to do an annual training on this? Would you expect it to be part of the already for those firms that already have? I mean, most firms hopefully already are doing an annual training generally around compliance and compliance related issues. Would this be something that could be a bolt on to that, where you might have a specific section of that training? Or would you expect there to be a standalone kind of AML related training specifically for now any affected investment advisor, you know, entity that, that would be subject to the rule? And maybe, Ed, we'll go ahead and start with you.
Well, I think training is important in terms of the frequency of the training. I would say annual would be the minimum that I would do training. But in the proposal, FinCEN talked about the training needing to be designed based on the roles of the individuals that are being trained. So you have to distinguish different roles, and that those roles will likely determine the nature, the scope, and the frequency of the training for each of those roles. So people who are very involved in the AML program likely are going to need more regular training. Those individuals that might not be as involved in the AML program but touch certain aspects of it, like client-facing people that are dealing with account opening and things like that, will at a minimum need to be trained at least annually. So it's important to make sure that when you're designing your program and designing your training, that you're distinguishing between the different activities that the firm engages in, the different risks associated with those activities, the roles people play, and make sure that the training is tailored to all of those items. And so that the training is dynamic and created in such a way that it addresses all the potential AML risks, the responsibilities, the policies, and then how those impact the different individuals in their roles.
Laura, any thoughts on your end?
Sure. So my vision would be that if they're already not affiliated with a BD or a sister firm, that they do a big initial rollout in training to cover the reg, to cover what a typical AML program looks like and what their AML program will look like. At that point, this, you know, when they do training, they already have a policy and procedure. And, you know, as Ed says, it's based on the risk facing the company. And that's really determined on their risk assessment, which I hope would be a part of any program that they would develop. And I think that it's very important to speak to the functional training. You know, just earlier we talked about, you know, completing the form and having a policy and a procedure for accepting currency if not likely, but if you end up taking currency. I think T1 settlement actually has a provision in it. I'm not a lawyer, so I take this with a grain of salt. I believe that a customer can come in and actually pay for a transaction by settlement day with currency. And it's not against the law to pay with currency. So having faced that once many, many years ago during T+4, that shows how old I am. I won't get into the story, but my point is, yes, I agree with Ed, you have to have a policy and procedure in the event of. But we need to have specific training for that, whoever is taking that job on. And initially, I would suspect that the assigned examiners would want to see exactly what you did for those roles first time out.
Sure.
So I would look at it that way. I would look at it as a big rollout. Here's what it is. Here's why it is. Here's how we're going to do it. And, you know, questions, assign somebody to respond, and so forth. What do you think, Ed?
No, I was just going to, that's spot on. And one of the aspects of the AML requirements that impacts training are the requirements to identify and report suspicious activities. So you want to make sure that as you develop your programs, that you're looking at what are the particular risks for money laundering, CFT, other illicit activities that my firm is at risk for. How are we going to monitor for those items? So what sort of monitoring systems are we going to put in place? And making sure that the alerting systems that you have are geared towards those particular red flags that you need to identify based on the risks associated with your firm. But there are a lot of activities that aren't the types of things that will be picked up through a monitoring system or exception reporting system, things like account opening and issues, red flags that might pop up during account opening. So it's also important, in addition to having a system for monitoring for suspicious activities, that you're training your staff, especially those client-facing staff, on what are the particular red flags that they might come across that you need to escalate for further review? Because it's one of the areas that the regulators really hone in on looking at AML programs is how are you monitoring for suspicious activities? When those are identified, how are you following up on those items? And importantly, are you documenting both the identification and follow-up to those items? So, and then ultimately, the determination of whether you need to file a SAR is an important consideration as well.
Right.
I think, too, that it's very important to have qualified people in the firm who have some AML experience. You can't just assign the baseball hat to somebody and say, okay, you're in charge of monitoring, when they have no idea what they're looking for. Even red flags. It's a red flag. Most people are not dealing with red flags. So that's not to take anything away from the talented salespeople, you know, all those very important functions in the advisory firm. But AML is a living, daily living thing.
Sure.
And the people who are managing all the little parts of it really need to be skilled and understand not only what they should do, but why they should do it.
That's a good segue. I certainly agree with that. And I would certainly say that there are probably hundreds or thousands of compliance officers across the United States that are giving a standing ovation to not just having compliance become like the kind of dumping ground for all the things that the firm has to do that at least relate to kind of that are in related areas. What I would say, though, that segues into my next question, which is, and you both have already touched on this in a couple of different ways, and I think it's really important for, you know, our listeners to get an idea behind, you know, we certainly have lots of firms that are dual-hatted, right? So you've got, you know, folks, a dual registrant that has both IA and BD activities. But in addition to that, lots of RIAs have affiliates, right, that are a BD themselves, right? They may not be a dual registrant, but they have an affiliate that's a BD. And we've talked about before, you know, that a lot of these requirements have been requirements for BDs and banks and other folks for many, many years, right? And so many of those firms likely have different systems and other stuff in place that can be helpful in that regard. But I guess I'm wondering, and maybe Ed, I'll come back to you for this one. You know, what should a dual registrant be thinking about, and especially for its investment advisory activities now? And, you know, will they need to create a separate program? Are there parts of the broker-dealer program they currently have in place that they can leverage? And just what are some other considerations for the firm to be thinking about there?
It's a great question. And FinCEN did recognize that many advisors have affiliates that are subject to these similar requirements, whether it's banks or broker-dealers. Oftentimes it is broker-dealers. And in such cases, RIA doesn't necessarily need to create separate programs. Now they can, and Laura, I'm interested in your take, because we had a little bit of discussion around this and how it impacts testing as well. But the important thing is, even though they can leverage aspects of the affiliates programs, they must make sure that the program covers all the AML, CFT requirements of each of the individual entities that are subject to the requirements, as well as the risks associated with those business activities. And so while you can leverage those programs, you don't need to have separate programs. If you have a single program, it needs to make sure that it covers all the specific requirements and the specific risks associated with each of the businesses of those covered institutions.
Laura, anything to add to that?
I totally agree with Ed on that one. I think that there's a great opportunity to leverage both knowledge and documentation. You can copy it, you can borrow it. You know, if you're not sure, you know, what your program should look like, you can look at an affiliate's, you know, ask permission to look at an affiliate's program. The single most important thing, however, is it must be tailored to your advisory business. It has to be tailored. The biggest mistake, in my opinion, I can say this because I have nothing to do with FINRA, except that I am an arbitrator, is I think they did a disservice while they were trying to be of service to the small firms by developing that template, because I still see that template out there with bad codifications on them, not, you know, considering beneficial ownership. I mean, it's a mess. If you don't know what you're doing, engage a consultant. That would be my advice.
Good. And, you know, when you talk about that tailoring, you know, some of the things to consider when tailoring it are, you know, the types of services, products, and accounts that the RIA offers and the risks associated with those, the types of customers you service, and including the risks associated with those customers, the profiles of those customers, the location of those customers, importantly. If you have foreign customers, you know, that might add a level of risk, especially depending on where they might be located, and the source of wealth and assets of those customers, among other things. So making sure that one of the first things that you likely want to do before creating your program is doing a risk assessment, understanding the nature of the business, distinguishing the nature of that business from your other affiliates like broker-dealers, and making sure that your comprehensive program, whether that's one program or separate programs for each of the areas, cover all of those particular risks.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great, because that starts to get into a couple of the key factors, right, that I think are super helpful for a lot of our listeners. And they're thinking about, like, if this proposal ends up going forward, what are some of the things that they're going to need to start to really be thinking about as they're developing their own policies and procedures and controls? And certainly that's a great list. Before we flush out some additional factors, though, I want to go back on the dual registrant. So for any of those dual registrants, essentially, if I'm hearing you right, and this is where I just want to confirm, you guys feel free to let me know if I've kind of framed this correctly. But if you're a dual registrant, you could do training, but you could do a combined training, but you would want your training to be able to articulate the specific AML CFT requirements for the BD part of the business and the IA part of the business. You couldn't just lump together training for one aspect of the business without covering the other parts and making sure essentially that all of the different requirements that are going to need to be met based on your BD or your IA business would need to be fully covered in that training. Same thing with, and then I guess the subsequent question. So the first one is the training. The second one is, for dual registrants, would you expect them to have two different audits performed, or could they have a combined audit and audit report done?
I'll defer to Laura on that one, because I know we talked about this earlier. You had some thoughts in terms of, you know, when it might be appropriate to do, you know, combined testing versus separate testing. Maybe just on the training piece, one thing to mention is that the doing combined training or separate training, it really depends on the program and how similar the programs are and the roles. And so if you have people who are employed by both the broker-dealer and investment advisors, and a lot of their activities are similar on both sides, and the requirements are similar, you know, having one training to cover both sides makes sense. It's more efficient. It's probably more effective to do it that way. But because the training needs to be really tailored to the role and to the particular activity that's being engaged in, you know, the more different they are, the more you'd probably want to consider doing separate training by role and by entity, if that makes sense for you. So that's one of the things that you should consider before you go and develop your training program is, should they be combined? Should they be separate? And some of the factors include how similar those activities are, and as well as the individuals that are involved in the different roles. But in terms of testing, I know, Laura, we talked about, you know, that the complications that come in.
Yeah, but I just want to go to the training topic for a second. So I don't know if you've seen this at your shop, Ed, but we've seen this here. Oftentimes we'll see a general training, And then we'll see periodic training, like quarterly, for the job function, specifically for the job function. And then in the third element of all of that, say it's BD, in their annual compliance meeting, they'll have one or two slides on AML, which is anything. They're just really covering the tracks. But sometimes having that kind of an approach to the training plan works. That way you can, you know, capitalize on the general knowledge base of everybody, you know, with some internally developed, say, presentation, right, that speaks to why we have the program, you know, what our CIP looks like and what our BOI looks like and so on, you know, new accounts and so on and so forth, and raising escalations for suspicious activity or unusual activity. And then you can, you know, get to the heart of the different important elements, like training for monitoring, training for, you know, investigations and reporting, training for new accounts, looking for unusual activity, looking at red flags and so forth. So that's always a great way to have a blend, what we call a blended approach in training. And then let's not dismiss any desk training that would be done while you're running the program out, right? You can take credit for that. You can take credit for distributing articles and advisories and guidance from FinCEN, guidance from the SEC. So, you know, and the most important thing is circulating the AML policy, right? That's training. You know, as long as somebody acknowledges that they received it and hopefully read it. But, you know, it's not today, the whole AML world is not just about AML. Now everything that falls under AML is called financial crime. And financial crime is a much bigger story than just AML and just CFT. I mean, they're very important, and that's what started this whole thing after the events of 9/11. But it really has morphed into this huge compliance requirement. And to just not get off this track for a moment, I also want to speak to listeners who may be responsible for budget. Because if you're with a small firm and you're anticipating that that firm will grow, so too will the compliance function and the expenses that go with it. And that is true with this too. You need to budget annually for your compliance function. You're going to need qualified people. You know, the same people don't stay in the same job forever. And they're more expensive. If you have somebody sitting around for 20 years that's in charge of compliance, and they leave and they go to a new firm, it's going to cost a couple of bucks more. Right? Mm-hmm. Same is true with independent testing. The bigger the program, the more expensive it's going to be because it's based on hours. So be mindful of budgeting. Most budgets in the capital markets world are August, right? And to roll out for the year end. But be mindful of that. That's huge. Now, to get to the testing piece, it really, as Ed said, does depend on the size of the program and the similarities of the program, whether or not you can combine the independent testing. Normally, at our firm, if you're under a different regulator, you have a couple of business lines and you're under different regulators, you do independent testing for each regulator, basically, because your audience is the regulator, the listener, the reader of your reports is your regulatory. It's also for your stakeholders to ensure that you've got a good, reliable, effective program going on. If you're a firm that's looking to go to the IPO world, or you're looking to be acquired, AML programs are chief among the most important things that you have to have well organized. So, yeah, you have to think of all of these things, right? But importantly is independent testing, the purpose of it is to determine the efficacy of the program. Is it satisfactory? Is it adequate? Those words are all really good in the independent testing and audit arena. So adequate is a lovely word. You want adequacy, right? But if you're very different in the services and the processes used to deliver those services and products, you really do need to consider whether it should be a separate engagement if you're going external. And if you're external, if you have internal audit or external internal audit, we call it, you want to be sure that you isolate each book.
Yeah, that's super helpful. Laura, thank you for all of that context. And I'm sure giving firms a lot to think about as far as evaluating for those dual registrants or those that have affiliates, you know, what those operations and items look like. And again, I think in probably a lot of cases, those services are not going to be similar enough. They're probably going to want to really think about setting up a separate engagement and getting a separate audit report, even though they might have the other side of their dual registrant business or an affiliate that is performing advisory services. They may need to set up a separate audit and report for that. I want to go back. You know, Ed, you had started to dive into some of the key factors about that RIAs would need to kind of keep in mind if the proposal was adopted. And you had talked about how you, when you're developing your testing, but certainly also, I guess you should be thinking about this when you're developing your policies and procedures. You talked about types of accounts, types of customers, location of customers, source of wealth. What are some other facets of that when it comes to the you know, some other key factors that advisors will want to keep in mind if the proposal is adopted?
Yeah, I mean, and there's much, and I think the history that we have with broker-dealers being in this space provides a lot of lessons learned that, you know, kind of help in when you're thinking through this as an RIA. What are those things you need to consider? Looking back at the examples over the years with broker-dealers. And one thing that FinCEN did put in their proposal is, again, acknowledging not only can you leverage affiliates programs under those caveats that we said earlier, you can also delegate certain functions to third parties, such as your custodian, like broker-dealers do with their clearing firms, or certain functions that can be delegated. But you can't delegate the responsibility for ensuring that those functions are carried out, or, and very importantly, the legal liability associated with making sure that those are carried out. So it's important that if you are going to delegate certain functions, that you make sure it's clear, both between, you know, the RIA and the party that it's being delegated to, and what exactly they're going to be doing, how they're going to be doing it, make sure that you're comfortable with their ability to carry out those functions. And then you're testing them periodically to make sure that those functions are being carried out. That's not very different than any type of third-party vendor relationship, but it's important to make sure that you're doing that because of the potential trouble you can get into if you delegate and it turns out that what you've delegated isn't being carried out. So that's one thing. You know, we talked about the considerations around the program and really understanding the business, the types of accounts, customer services, and those things. Those are very important. But one of the things that Laura had talked about that I think is really important to consider is when you're thinking about your AML officer, is making sure that they're qualified and that they're knowledgeable, but also that they have a good handle on AML requirements. So they need to know AML, like Laura had mentioned. They also have to really understand the RIA's business so they can understand the AML requirements in the context of the firm's business and the risks associated with that business. And making sure that you have somebody that has the capacity, the resources, the authority to be able to effectively carry out the AML program. So that's another thing that's really important. Another area that FinCEN touched on in the proposal is customer due diligence and what's expected with respect to customer due diligence. And they talked about creating risk profiles for customers, identifying the expected types of transactions that you'd expect to see for those types of customers. We mentioned earlier understanding the source of wealth and assets, and then using that to create a baseline. So when you are assessing activity and monitoring, looking for suspicious activity, that you have a baseline for which to judge that. So if you have a retail customer that's a senior investor, you know, what type of activity would you expect to see from a customer like that? So if you see activity that's significantly different than that, that might be a red flag that you want to look into. So those are some of the key things. But also talking about the compliance officer, you know, I know in earlier podcasts that you've done, Patrick, and work that the NSCP has done, there's been a big focus on CCO liability. And one of the areas where compliance officers have gotten in trouble in the past is with respect to AML programs. So it's really important that whoever you get to be in that role really understands that area well and has the resources to set up a reasonable program, and that program is implemented appropriately, just to make sure that they're aware of and able to address any potential liability that comes along with that role.
Another good thing to consider is that they should be independent. You know, that's a little harder for the senior management to take.
Sure. Yeah,
they've got to be able to exercise independence because if they really know their ML, they'd be protecting the firm.
Right. And,
senior management needs to understand that. So they need to be properly trained too.
Well,
they own risk, the AML risk actually.
Right. Yeah, let's. I want to go back, and I appreciate all of that context. It, the fact that, you know, when you first mentioned it, Laura, and then Ed, you kind of, you know, reminding the audience there again about the importance of having an AML officer, right, that is knowledgeable about AML requirements, that understands the RIA's business, that understands the risks that are going to be associated with the firm, and can speak articulately about those things in a way that's meaningful. How important that is. It gets back, and maybe this is a good segue as we kind of start to wind down our conversation and we look at like the future of this area. And I know we're talking about a proposal right now, but you know, I think in a little, some of the stuff around the technical requirements of the AMLCO and also them having independence and other things get into, well, what is the cost of compliance here? Especially for a lot of firms who, this is going to be a new requirement for those investment advisor firms. And so, Laura, as we start to wrap this up, maybe I'll look to you a little bit for some of your thoughts. You know, what is the cost of compliance here? Do you anticipate an increase in regulatory focus and related costs in this area kind of continuing into the future? I'll say both as part of the FinCEN proposal, but even maybe separate and apart from that.
Well, certainly the get up and go costs are significant, right? That is designing a program, whether you go outside and engage someone to design it for you along the risk assessment and they visit with a firm like Ed's, for example, or if they're going to borrow it, obviously they're not going to spend the kind of money that you might imagine. But I suspect that most will design a program of their own, tailored to their business, because it should be. They may have to go outside and hire somebody that has qualifications, but at the very least, they may have to send their compliance, somebody from their existing compliance team that they're going to designate as the AMLCO, may have to send them out for AMLCO training, whether it's private training or there isn't too much you can buy out there specifically for an AML compliance officer. But certainly there's plenty of AML content. And there are coaches. There are coaches out there that can work with an individual to help them, you know, raise the bar of where they've been to, you know, this new role. So there will obviously be cost in that. It's the continuing cost that really gets to senior management, right? Because, you know, the cost of compliance, yes, it's more expensive. And as there are more as there becomes more teeth in AML programs and financial crime programs, the more you have to engage to make sure that you're not involved in those typologies or you're not involved in dealing with the type of client that sometimes is presented as bringing extra risk. Firms will make a decision about risk, just like banks do. You know, how much percentage of risk do I want to engage with? And they might say no more than 10%. Or no more than 15%, whatever the magic number might be, if they even get to that point, which may, you know, dissuade them from doing business with certain types of clients because of the risk that it presents. So there's all sorts of possibilities here, and all of it comes down to cost, you know. So when I mentioned earlier, you know, the initial budget rollout for a program, you know, maybe XYZ, but it's the continuation of an efficient and effective program that may cost a couple of bucks more each year over year.
Yeah.
Just to follow up on that, I think those are that's all really important on that cost side of the left ledger. But, you know, in talking with senior management at your firms, it's important also to make sure that they understand the cost of noncompliance, right? And so in the AML area, on the broker-dealer side, sort of learning that lesson, the fines for noncompliance in the AML space have been really significant. So the regulators aren't messing around when it comes to AML deficiency. So it's important to make sure that you understand that those costs can be high. The other costs that's a little bit more intangible are the reputational costs that you can have, because typically what you're trying to guard for here, and in most of these cases, the firm itself isn't a perpetrator of any bad act. It's that they didn't catch a customer that may have been involved in bad acts. And those bad acts are typically crimes and things that go through. So for a firm that does get identified with a weak AML program, or where there's findings related to customers who are doing money laundering or other illicit acts through the firm, and it results in some sort of regulatory action, it can have pretty significant reputational risks to the firm. So those are some things that the costs are high for implementation and ongoing compliance, but also you have to factor in, you know, what are the costs of non-compliance when you're factoring that in. And you'd mentioned something earlier, Laura, that was really important to consider here, is that it's when they talk about this, it's broad. You know, people think about just money laundering, right? So we got to guard against money laundering, or now terrorist financing as well. But if you look back at broker-dealers, you know, FINRA used their AML reviews and AML requirements to go after firms that were involved in things like penny stock manipulation and penny stock liquidation. So any type of illicit activity can fall under this. So firms have to think broadly when they're setting up their programs. And I would anticipate some of the other areas that might be covered under this that regulators are going to expect firms to be on the lookout for when they're implementing these programs are other types of illicit activities, such as senior or elder abuse, cyber incidents, just financial fraud. Those types of things will all come under. Those are illicit activities that you should be monitoring for suspicious activities for, and make sure that your programs are set up to look for those types of things and file suspicious activity reports when necessary. So it's important here to think broadly when you're thinking about your AML programs.
One other risk that applies here is the behavioral risks of the professionals in the company. Historically, investment advisors have not been rigidly monitored, right? They've been do what they need to do to keep their customers happy and do the business of the firm, et cetera. Unlike BDs, there are very rigid procedures, rigid guidelines, and certain disciplines that have been adapted over the years. And take something as simple as record keeping for BSA. If a wire is issued over $3,000, certain requirements apply. The investment advisor salesperson isn't necessarily going to have known about that unless they're specifically trained on it. And they can't sit down at a console and send money.
Mm-hmm.
They presently sit down at a console and send money, right? Of any amount, because that's what their customer wanted. So they're servicing the customer. So there may be some bumpers that they're going to hit while they're driving down the lane with a new program that they may, you know, shout about, but in the end, they're going to have to comply. And those behavioral issues are tough when you're used to doing something the same old way for all these years. And I've been around the street a long time, and I've seen a lot of different things come into play over these years. And the behavioral part is the biggest nuisance of all, because you have to manage the people. It's not just the processes, but you have to manage the people, and you got to keep everybody happy.
Right. It's the hardest to control.
From the manager's standpoint, which I had many years as, I will tell you, it's going to be challenging.
Yeah. So, one, thank you both so much for walking us through what is a very expansive and, I think, complicated area. You all broke it down really nice, and I think gave our listeners a lot to really dive into, especially for investment advisors who are going to need to certainly up their game if the rule proposal is ultimately if it gets adopted in full. Really appreciate all of that additional context. Thank you both so much for being so gracious with your time and for coming on the show today. I wouldn't be doing my job if I let you off the hook without at least doing something a little bit fun at the end of these episodes, because we've gotten into some heavy compliance topics. So I'll end with an easy one. I don't know if you're like me, if you've got Olympics on the brain right now, but I've got Summer Olympics going real hard in the Hayes household. In fact, my daughter set up their own obstacle course decathlon yesterday with some building blocks and other related items around the house, which was a lot of fun. So real quickly, what is your favorite Summer Olympics event? Laura, we'll start with you.
There, I tell you, I don't follow the Olympics.
Oh, no.
The only following I did was Celine Dion.
Okay. Hey, we can, you can go with the opening ceremony. That's fine.
There you go.
Opening ceremony. That, there you go. Ed?
Well, I love the opening ceremonies as well. I did spend yesterday watching a lot of the initial events, and I got to say, it changes every time I turn on a different thing, because I think they're all really fun to watch, especially the more obscure ones. So I watched archery, equestrian jumping, ping pong, or I'm sorry, table tennis. Yeah. All of those I think are fabulous to watch, because those are the kind of things that you don't normally get to see, and it's fun to watch. And they're so super serious and so well trained in all those areas. It's really fun.
It's incredible. And in fact, to play on that fact, like, I find myself, I love the Summer Olympics. And one of the reasons why is because I feel like I'm living, for any dodgeball movie fans, I'm watching ESPN 8, The Ocho. Okay. Like the sports that they have, where I watched an hour's worth of badminton yesterday just because it was on, and it's really entertaining how fast they are playing. It's just like, you know, me playing at a summer picnic, playing badminton. I'll just say that the Hayes family does not quite measure up that I saw yesterday. Right. So anyway, Ed, Laura, thank you so much for coming on the show today again to walk us through really complicated, subject matter like AML and the new FinCEN proposal. Really, really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and look forward to having you both back on the show here at some point down the road.
Thanks again.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
The final part of today's show features another segment of What's On My Mind. As a quick reminder for some of our new listeners, this segment represents a tip of the cap to all those editorial artists from years past, and will often include a unique perspective or nuanced take and highlight how it relates to the investment management industry and our securities compliance family. In today's What's On My Mind, I'd like to take a quick look at the Olympics. But first, let's talk about American author and professor Adam Grant, and more specifically, a tweet from Adam on X. In the message, Grant states, "Pieces of paper are a poor proxy for potential. Oftentimes, our greatest achievements are not based on innate ability, but in overcoming and succeeding in an area where we might have initially struggled. We admire people at their peak. We don't get to see the distance they've traveled." An example of this that I would pull out and argue that Grant has also talked about previously is the Martin Luther King, "I Have a Dream" speech. Many people look at that speech and they think to themselves, how incredible and what a fantastic speaker Martin Luther King Jr. was. And all of that is true. He was an incredible speaker, inspiring and motivational. Martin Luther King Jr. had also been speaking in speech competitions, or began competing in speech competitions, at the age of 15. By the time he gave the "I Have a Dream" speech, he was already 20 years practiced at giving these types of, oration, and giving that type of oration and providing speeches of that ilk. In that same year that he gave the "I Have a Dream" speech, Martin Luther King Jr. gave 350 speeches in that same year alone. And if we apply some of these lessons to the athletes that we've been seeing in the Paris Olympics, like Simone Biles, Katie Ledecky, Sydney McLaughlin-Leverone, let's be fair, they make it look easy. Better yet, they make perfection look easy. But don't let that fool you. That's not just because Simone, Katie, and Sydney are just naturally great. They have spent years of their life in practice after practice after practice, pushing themselves physically, mentally, emotionally, to be their very best selves. From the compliance officer's perspective, it's easy to feel like oftentimes we are inadequate no matter how hard we try, and that there are some parts of our compliance program that we just can't get right. Two things on that. Number one, don't forget that the Simone Biles you see today was not built in a day or a week or a month or a year. And furthermore, Simone is the perfect example of someone who is arguably the greatest of all time, and yet even she fell down sometimes. Even she fell short. But the difference with Simone is that every time she fell down, she got back up. So when you're struggling in your compliance program, just know the greatness takes time. Set a plan, maximize resources, and work really, really hard to make it happen. The second thing I'll mention there is, where perfectionism is an impediment to growth, don't waste time perfecting something that's not necessarily meaningful, or that's relatively insignificant, rather than learning something more difficult or meaningful or advancing yourself or your compliance program professionally, personally, emotionally, psychologically. Adam Grant frames it like this: don't shame past mistakes over educating your future self. And I would say, don't let prior mistakes stop you from making your compliance program the very best that it can be. Remember the motto of this show: make it better than the way we found it. And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, CALFI and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guests, Ed Wegener and Laura Goldzung, for doing a fantastic job of breaking down the new FinCEN AML rule proposal and related customer identification program requirements for RIAs and exempt reporting advisors. Please join us again next time on the Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance in Context Podcast, or on X using the handle @ compliancepod. You can like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or go to complianceincontextpodcast.com to listen and learn more.